Today we've got a special show for you, looking back at some of the best of our interview programme, One-on-One, in 2009. In February, we spoke to Martin C. Putna, a leading Czech Roman Catholic intellectual, who's also head of the Václav Havel Library in Prague. Jan Richter asked Putna how Czechs came to become one of Europe's most atheistic nations.
I think the Czech history is guilty for it. I think the basic problem is that during this long history, Czechs changed, deliberately or less deliberately, their religion. Till 15th century, the only religion was Catholicism. Then in the 15th century, majority of the nation chosen Reformation, or pre-Reformation, we can say. Then in 17th century, they again converted back to Catholicism, less deliberately, we have to say. And then in 19th century, during the National Revival, they again sided with Protestantism, but without becoming real Protestants. The Protestantism has become something like national ideology, but without real religious understanding and without converting to Protestantism. And I think that this is the reason, that there were too many changes. And then finally, Czechs in the 20th century decided, well, it was enough of all religion. And the communists were very successful when sticking to this tradition of Czech liberalism, so to speak.
Many were hoping that after the fall of communism, there would be something like a religious revival in the country, but that never happened. Did the Catholic Church make a mistake there?
The Church was absolutely not prepared for that. The Church lived either in underground or in the half-official situation of being controlled by the state and by the police, etc. And the Church was not prepared. There was a group of Catholic intellectuals working underground, Tomáš Halík, for instance, and some absolutely wonderful priests, but the majority was not prepared. And there was a short revival, but it lasted only like 5-6 months. After the revolution, in the frame of the general euphoria that now everything which was prohibited is now popular and fashionable. But it lasted only a few months, and then the Czechs, they have lost their enthusiasm for churches in general, not only for the Catholic Church, when seeing the reality of the Church.
Martin C. Putna. In July, Chris Johnstone welcomed the distinguished Czech-born historian Igor Lukáš to the studios of Radio Prague. Professor Lukáš, who spent much of his life in America, is the author of Czechoslovakia Between Stalin and Hitler, The Diplomacy of Edvard Beneš in the 1930s. Given that the subject is one of the more complex figures in modern Czech history, Chris asked the historian how he personally evaluated President Beneš.
It's obviously a very loaded question that no one can answer successfully in the course of a minute or two. I would say simply that since Beneš was a politician, we have to evaluate his achievements as a politician. And from everything we know, he appeared to be a very smart political analyst. Unfortunately, when we look at him as a politician, we have to come to terms with the fact that he left behind a legacy of failure, and that in all the big moments of his life and his political career, obviously 1938, 1939, and then 45 to 48, we see a legacy of failure. So when we looked at him as a politician, it is really hard to give him even a passing grade. As a human being, I find him a tragic person who was destroyed by the millstones of both East and West.
Looking maybe now at the archives, both in the Czech Republic, which have been opened up over the last years, and maybe those in the Soviet Union, which haven't really been opened up, do you think there will be in the future, as a result of the archives, some revelations about Czech history that hitherto have not been known?
I am fairly confident that the French, British, German, archival sources have been exhausted, and I think the Czech archival sources have also been exhausted or are about to be completely exhausted. Obviously, there can be great surprises in the Soviet archives, especially in the archive that is considered, I think they call it presidential or Stalin's archive. I believe that there could also be some remarkable revelations coming out of the NKVD or KGB, whatever one wants to call it, FSB these days, the Soviet Security Special Services Archive. I'm sure that the Soviet Special Services were very active in Central Europe and specifically in Prague. Whether it could conceivably trump what we already know about Chamberlain and Daladier and Hitler and Benesch and so on, I am skeptical. I think we pretty much understand the global picture.
Professor Igor Lukash was Chris Johnstone's guest in July. Another highly respected academic we spoke to in 2009 was Peter Demetz. He left Czechoslovakia in 1948 and later became a professor of German studies and literature at Yale. He's also well known as the author of Prague in Black and Gold and other works. Professor Demetz's family was part Jewish and part German, and he went to both German and Czech schools. Jan Richter asked him which mentality or group he had most identified with.
The question is asked from today's point of view. At that time, you could have an identity as a citizen of the Czechoslovak Republic. There was President Masaryk, who, to my youthful mind, and even now, represents the best of the Czech liberal and rational tradition. And you could be of any nationality and yet profess your belief in the importance of the Czechoslovak Republic, which in the middle of Germany and Austria and elsewhere, and Hungary, was one of the rare cases of a functioning democratic and parliamentarian democracy, in contrast to many of the neighbors who had either totalitarian or semi-totalitarian regimes.
A significant Czech scholar, Pavel Eisner, said after the Second World War that Anglo-Saxons will never understand Germans as much as Czechs do. Do you think that there's some truth to that, that Czechs have a special insight into the German soul?
They may have a special insight, but they also have a particular perspective. They may have been too close to German developments, especially in the 30s. And that may have, permit me to say, narrowed these perspectives. You remember the famous saying by the Czech historian, 19th century historian Palacký, that the meaning of Czech history was in the conflict between Czechs and Germans, the tension between Czechs and Germans. And though it may be true for many centuries, I think it's not enough. There were other aspects of the Czech experience, let's say the difference between Hussitism and Catholicism, etc., etc.
I always found it difficult to imagine that after 6 years of having been occupied by a foreign power, students like you would study the language and culture of the occupiers. How did you feel studying German after the war? Did you first have to forgive them for what they'd done?
I tried to oppose them, because at that time, when you studied German literature, you try to study it in a way that was not Nazi influenced. That means you wanted to rescue something of the German heritage that was untainted by the Nazis. And that was also a requirement when you studied Marxism, for instance. I remember that my professor in 46 or 47 once asked me and said, well, there is a meeting downtown and we have to talk about the question whether in 46 or 47 it is necessary to study German. And I told him, well, maybe if you are interested in Marx and Engels, you better know your German, because if you want to interpret the sacred texts, you have to know what they are saying. And I think what the few German scholars did at the time outside Germany is develop a scholarship in opposition to 1933.
Professor Peter Demetz, who was interviewed by Jan Richter. Somebody else with an interest in history, though taking a rather different approach, is Tom Zahn. He's a Prague-based genealogist whose company tracks down clients' long-lost Czech and Slovak relatives, in many cases reuniting both parties. Zahn had done research into his own family tree in Ukraine, he told Rosie Johnston, and that's how he ended up making a business out of such research.
Some people had seen the work that I had done for my family, because whenever I spoke with anybody about it, I showed them this genealogy that went back to sometime in the 1700s, 1713, 1718. And they said, wow, can you do that for us? Because at the time, these records were not available through any other source. You had to literally come here or find somebody here. So it kind of became a little bit of a niche for us. I came back with the idea that we would start doing this research for people. And the first one, I can remember, I had to go back to Slovakia, and I was hitchhiking. I took a wild bus ride from Levoča into the mountains, and I thought, I'm going into a different country. I didn't, you know, really know what I was getting myself into. But when I got to the office there, the woman in this tiki potok spoke perfect English, and it was really a surprise because it was a successful job and the family was happy. So one thing led to another. After a few successes, I guess word started to get out, and from that point on, we really officially began to do this work.
Tom Zahn, who was interviewed by Rosie Johnston at the start of February. By the way, Rosie has since moved on and is now herself doing some research, recording the testimonies of Czech and Slovak immigrants to the United States. Englishman John Tregellis saw his own personal history take a major turn after the fall of the Iron Curtain. Tregellis, whose mother's family had come from Moravia, moved to Prague very soon after the Velvet Revolution, as he told David Vaughan, who was his colleague at Radio Prague in the early 1990s.
I worked for Radio Prague for about 2 years after coming over here. My appointment was sealed in true Czech fashion by the then head of the English section over a pint of beer somewhere at the top of Wenceslas Square within 5 minutes' walk of the Radio Prague studios. And I am very grateful in retrospect for the experience that I was given, because essentially someone with no journalistic training was allowed to walk into a studio and start editing tapes, interviewing business and political leaders. It was a particularly fascinating time because everything was in flux, and therefore whatever area of a society you chose to cover, you were bound to come up with some interesting information.
And the radio was very different in those days from today. I mean, it was very relaxed, I remember, for a start. We didn't really worry very much about deadlines, and it was all extremely low-tech, wasn't it?
That's true. I had very usefully taken a touch typing course whilst I was still in England, and that was enormously valuable because in the radio we still typed out our news bulletins on typewriters, vintage circa 1960, which required a great deal of force to get the keys to strike through the carbon paper. All of the editing was done by splicing physical tapes on these large machines. And as far as the relaxed atmosphere is concerned, I seem to remember we used to roll up to an editorial meeting at about 10 o'clock, at which the day's tasks were distributed. And then I would make a bunk for the radio canteen, where they had a wonderful array of Czech pastries, all with different names, and I tried to work my way through all of these and learn their different names. So by the time I'd got through that, it was almost time for lunch, and I do seem to remember that we knocked off about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it wasn't a very taxing working day, but you probably remember the old pre-revolutionary saying, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. We weren't paid enormous amounts for doing this work, but it was a wonderful time because every evening was free from an early hour, and you could spend a lot of time with friends in the activity that was very popular back in those days, or not popular, but almost inevitable, which was trying to find a place in a pub, because you will remember, David, as well as I do, that before the revolution and after, there weren't enough spaces in pubs, and we used to spend whole evenings going from one pub to another trying to find a place where they would let us sit down.
Those were the days, it sounds like. John Tregellis, who worked here at Radio Prague in the early 1990s. And if you've just joined us, you are, of course, listening to Radio Prague with me, Ian Willoughby. In today's special New Year's Day show, we're taking a look back at some of the highlights of our one-on-one interview programme in 2009. Among a number of great Czech musicians we spoke to last year was Rudy Linka, a jazz guitar player who now lives and works in New York. Every summer, however, Rudy is home in the Czech Republic, bringing top-class musicians to town squares around the country with the Bohemia Jazz Fest. One time he brought the legendary guitarist John Scofield to Prague, and the two ended up busking on Charles Bridge.
That was really funny because we went on vacation to Prague. That was, I think it was 2000 or 2001. And John's wife, she is, she bought a book about Prague and she was studying the book. And in the book was that all the musicians are playing at Charles Bridge, you know, and it's just like, this is the thing to do. And she said to us before we left, she said, guys, do you know what you do? You take two guitars and you play at Charles Bridge and let's see how much money you make. And for that money, we will go and have a dinner and we cannot spend one dime more than what you made. So we had our, you know, two acoustic guitars and we went to Charles Bridge and we sat down right in the middle. And they took out these guitars and started to play. And the moment we started to play, so it was a little crowd around us because it was people who were watching us and thinking like, no, this is not happening. These guys look like somebody. But also immediately, these two police officers showed up and started to ask, you know, if we have the permit to do that, you know. And of course we didn't. And I was pretending that I don't speak Czech, and John was totally honest saying I don't speak Czech. Of course they didn't speak English, and it was really, they just wanted to take us to the police station. And luckily enough, it was a TV, Czech TV, walking by because they were filming something on the other side. So they were walking by and they started to film this. And this Czech reporter said to these police, and these guys are really famous. And this whole thing was caught on TV, on the tape, and they showed it on the main news the same day. And it was really funny. And so what happened is that the police said, okay, you can play one song. So we played one song. We didn't make any money because we didn't have the permit. And we almost got arrested. But, it was one of the most bizarre periods in my life, I think.
The jazz guitar player Rudy Linka. Our final extract in this special program comes from another interview that I did. It was meant to be a one-on-one, but then the interview's partner came too, and it turned into a kind of double interview. The legendary American cartoonist Robert Crumb and his wife Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, also a cartoonist, were in town for the Prague Writers' Festival, and I've got to say that meeting them was one of the highlights of my year. With his tie and boater hat, Crumb looked rather different from many of his original hippie fans in the 1960s. So I asked him, did he feel a bit out of step with the times?
Yes, I did feel out of step with the times, and I tried to be a hippie, but I really couldn't pull it off. I was just too weird and too, I don't know, I couldn't, because hippie was a style, you know, of long hair and attitude, and I didn't like any of the music, and, you know, so yeah, I felt, I really tried to be a hippie and get in there and loosen up and be groovy, but it was hopeless, I couldn't do it.
And Aileen, were you a hippie chick, or was that before your time?
No, I was at the love-ins and be-ins, I had tons of boyfriends, I wore no underwear and short skirts and had hairy legs, and lived on communes, and I had a ball, and Robert was like an old man in a young man's body, and now he's like a young old man. He kind of grew into it, but you know, he was just completely square and strange and eccentric always, and he hasn't really changed at all, but I had a great time.
When I first met Aileen in 1971, she was a classic New York Jewish girl hippie of the time, just, you know, out of central casting completely.
Among your works, Mr. Crumb, is Kafka, A Beginner's Guide. I think it also has different titles now. Yeah. But what's your relationship to the work of Kafka?
Well, before I did that book, I never read Kafka, didn't know anything about him. And then the guy who wrote it, David Merowitz, proposed that project to me, so I started reading Kafka, and then I developed a deep kinship, brotherhood with Kafka. I felt so close to him by the end of that project. It was spooky. I felt his ghost was looking over my shoulder. It was quite a deep experience, actually.
Also, you have described cartooning as a lonely job. But is it a lonely job in a bad way, or do you like the fact that it's a lonely job?
I like that it's a lonely job, that I can sit in my room by myself and do it, because I mostly like to just be in my room by myself, mostly. It's dealing with other human beings is stressful for me. I'm somewhat autistic or something, I don't know.
But you two also work together. How does that work in practical terms?
Well, you know, when we get into writing together, we kind of become a comedy team. Like, I don't know if you know George Burns and Gracie Allen. They were like an old vaudeville team and a TV team. And we kind of get into the George and Gracie mentality where Robert puts out a line and then I take off with it, you know, and he takes notes really fast. And we have kind of we get into our reporter mentality for covering an event, or just we have a way of being in that comic strip. And then when we're actually working on it, we do everything in pencil first all the writing, then we each pencil our characters in, and then we each take a page and do the inking, and then we switch pages.
Was it a big change then for you working with somebody else?
Yeah, sure. It's a completely different thing. But yeah, I used to do it with my older brother Charles when we were kids. That's one way we learned to draw comics was his idea, really, of doing it together and going back and forth. I take on one character, he takes on the other, and that's how Aileen and I work. And we first started doing that in 1972, you know, not that long after we first met. But it's easy to do that with Aileen because I just feed her a lead line and she just goes into her kind of Jewish comedy routine with it. It's easy. That practically writes itself, those things we do together. But Aileen, you know, she's also in her own right a storytelling cartoonist that does her own autobiographical comics, which are great in their own right. She was the first woman cartoonist to draw personal autobiographical comics.
Robert and Aileen Crumb, bringing today's special Radio Prague New Year's Day program to an end.